Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 66, recorded August 22nd, 2012. Tim O'Reilly. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special bonus offer, go to Stamps.com, click the radio microphone, and use the promo code Triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we talk to great minds, interesting people, people making big changes in the world. And boy, there is no one making bigger changes and who's done more interesting writing and thinking and talking about the internet and technology than Tim O'Reilly.
I like to say my reputation exceeds me.
It does not. It's funny. My producer was bringing me O'Reilly books. Anybody who's a programmer knows these books very well. The ones with the animals on the cover, and I have quite a few. Some of them out of date. I don't know if I'll be using this PayPal Hacks book anytime soon or Practical Mod Pearl. But there's quite a few of these. But you don't think of yourself as a publisher, I don't think.
No, I don't. I 10 or 15 years ago, I kind of wrote our mission as changing the world by spreading the knowledge of innovators.
Ooh.
And we've tried to figure out different ways to do that. You know, books certainly were a fantastic way. Conferences are a fantastic way. Early stage investing, which we do with our venture arm, O'Reilly Alpha Tech Ventures, is a fantastic way. And we're always looking for new ones. But the fundamental notion of what we do is that we look for disruptive technology, typically coming from the edges, and then we try to amplify it. You know, so and that might be writing down what people know and publishing it as a book. It might be, bringing people together around a community. But the fundamental goal is to add value to people who are change makers.
It's actually interesting that you realized so long ago, 15 years ago, that the mission wasn't publishing books. People often focus, you know, they always said that was what went wrong with the railroads, was they thought they were in the railroad business. But you recognized early on that you were not in the book business.
That's right. And I think there are a lot of things we've tried to think long term about, you know, even in the book business. You know, we started working on ebooks we published our first ebook in 1987.
Oh, man.
View of Perspective. And
a long time ago. What could you could read it on a computer. That was it, probably.
It was for HyperCard.
HyperCard. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was what led us to the World Wide Web. So we were there at the World Wide Web very close to the beginning. And, you know, of course, we then found that even though we started out looking at it as a book reader, you know, build a web browser for reading books, we soon discovered that it was also a possible way of launching an online magazine, an online web portal. We launched GNN in 1993, early 90s, and that was the first web portal and first website to have advertising. So, you know, we kind of just try to figure out, well, what are we trying to make happen? And, I think we have, as you said, created a lot of stir over the years. We've managed to encourage a lot of interesting technologies, and that works. By the way, I noticed down on your triangulation bar, you say O'ReillyMedia.com. It's O'Reilly.com.
No media. The company's O'Reilly Media, but there's no
media.
Yeah, that's
right. It's O'Reilly.com or at O'Reilly Media on Twitter, or, of course, for me personally, at Tim O'Reilly.
And you should follow Tim O'Reilly. He always says interesting things on Twitter. I remember very well going to the first or one of the first internet worlds, and there was a wall of internets in a box. It was a box that says internet in a box.
That's right.
There was a wall there.
For a few years, we're in the software business.
Yeah.
Because one of those problems early on was getting people on the internet. And, so we had a product that was, you know, here's internet access together with online with a copy of our whole internet users guide and catalog, a web browser, because everything had to be bootstrapped.
You didn't have any of it. In fact, you didn't even include, just to give some people an idea, WinSock, because Windows didn't, in that time frame, didn't know about the internet or TCP/IP. So you had to have your own stack that you would install.
That's right.
To make it work.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. And is it at the Spry Mosaic?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember very well. It was probably the first thing I used to get online, come to think of it.
Yeah.
Or on the internet. So let's go back to the beginning, because I wonder how you got this sense that so early on that this was, that something was happening here. Because you were way ahead. You beat Bill Gates to the punch, at least.
That wasn't too hard. I mean, he was a follower. But I have to say, I have always dabbled in a lot of these things and been a cheerleader more than necessarily a real practitioner.
Well, we need that. We need people to do it, but we also need people to support it and to facilitate.
So, I started out doing documentation. I had a small documentation consulting company, and we saw that people were looking for the same manuals. We noticed that software was getting standardized. We happened to fall into Unix, and that was a really good thing. And we found that there was not a lot of good documentation, so we started writing our own in between times when we didn't have any paid work. And then we turned some of those things into books, and people were willing to pay us for them. And, the thing that was really interesting in our early days was that we were just trying to be useful. We would say, we don't have any work right now in our consulting business, but there's no manual for VI. Let's write one. and we turned some of these things into books, and people were willing to pay for them. And bit by bit, the book publishing business became sufficiently successful that we stopped doing the paid tech writing consulting. But the thing that was really, I think, always distinguished us was this idea that we were interested in creating value. And early on, people would say, why didn't you do a book? Why haven't you done a book on TCP/IP, for example, was one. And we said, well, because Doug Comer did a really great one for Addison Wesley. Why would we do another one? Everybody else was, wow, somebody has a best-selling book. You got to come out with a competitor.
Right.
We're like, well, why would you do that? Just for the money?
Just for the money, Tim. Exactly.
Pretty out there, So it kind of led us in some very different directions because we didn't do the same stuff as everybody else. We just did the stuff that was still needed. Yeah. And that's kind of led to, kind of one of the things that I've said pretty widely repeated, although it's not a quote from me originally. It was Brian Irwin, who used to work for me, said, create more value than you capture. It's one of our...
Love it.
Company values. And I've been thinking a lot about that lately. I've increasingly been spending time thinking about the economy and, some of the distortions that we have, the financial crash of 2008 being driven by companies that were very good at extracting value from the economy, but not really creating it. They were, in fact, destroying value. Meanwhile, you have people say, take Tim Berners-Lee, as somebody we all know, who created a huge amount of value, didn't get very much of it. And, from a policy point of view, you say, if we're really trying to increase innovation in this country, we have to start measuring and rewarding value creation as distinct from value capture. Because if all you measure is the capture part of it, you're going to get it wrong. So I gave a talk at our open source convention this year called The Clothesline Paradox, which was a reference back to a paper about alternative energy that was written in 1975 and published in Stuart Brand's Coevolution Quarterly, his successor to the Whole Earth Catalog. And it makes a pretty simple point. If you put your clothes in the dryer, the energy gets measured and counted. It goes on your utility bill. You hang your clothes on the clothesline, it appears to disappear from the economy. But it doesn't really disappear from the economy. You just save money. Which you have to spend on something else. And so I gave this talk at the open source convention looking at open source through that lens. People say, well, gosh, open source hasn't had that big an economic impact after all. Look at the size of Red Hat. You know, I mean, you know, it's a nice little, you know, nice software company, but nothing like the scale of Google or Apple, or, you know, and you kind of go, well, you know, of course, Google and Apple built on top of open source software too, just as much. But even more than that, you look at, we end up doing a study with this company, Bluehost, which is part of Endurance Group, which is now, I think, the largest web hosting company in the U.S. And, you know, looking at, you know, the web hosting market, that's a very thin skin. It's a subscription business model on open source software. They're basically selling subscription access to, you know, a web server, you know, a domain name, or WordPress, MySQL, you know, for a monthly subscription fee. And that's actually a pretty sizable industry. But even more than that, we came across a study by McKinsey that made the case that businesses with a website have a 10% increase in productivity. You know, you think about the, you know, these days, if you don't have a website, you're kind of screwed if you're a small business, you're a restaurant or, you know, local business. And, you know, but because of open source software, you can get one for $5 a month, you know, and you can do it yourself. And that's this enormous impact on the economy. So we actually looked at Bluehost's customer base. We said, okay, how many of them are there? They did a survey of how big the businesses were, and we kind of did the math, and we said, oh my God, this is like a, you know, there's $1 trillion of economic activity here. And it's kind of interesting, you know, that's represented by that customer base. And you know, what's the productivity gain? I mean, again, I'm taking this McKinsey study. If you say, well, if there is a 10% productivity gain, you're talking about a, you know, $150 billion impact. You know, that's pretty sizable for something that seems invisible. And so I've been thinking a lot about other kinds of clothesline paradox economies, you know, and it's a wonderful filter for thinking about this sort of value creation versus value capture notion. And are we paying the right people? You know, so for example, I have a 3-year-old grandson and he likes to watch YouTube, and he watches videos that were made by other little kids. You know, they do Thomas the Tank Engine crash videos. And
that's awesome.
You know, think about that, and you go, okay, so he watches a commercial video and somebody's getting paid. He watches a user contributed video and nobody gets paid.
So maybe Google.
Well, no, Google doesn't actually get paid. Google only puts advertising on commercial.
Well, good for them. So, yeah. So kid videos are not, there's ad free.
Well, it might be, because if for example somebody uses a commercial soundtrack,
yes,
the videos, Google auto detects that, right, and pay not the person who uploaded the video, but they pay the rights holder. So that's why you're not getting these takedown notices on YouTube anymore, because, yeah, you know, I actually heard this really interesting story. It was down at this conference called VidCon, which is this amazing event. I highly recommend it next year. There were 7,000 people there. It felt like being at a Beatles concert in 1964. You know, thousands of screaming girls as various YouTube stars came out on stage. Right. You know, it's right. Unbelievable.
It's hard because people nobody's ever heard of, except that they're huge on YouTube.
Huge on YouTube. You know, people with, you know, a couple of million people in their channel, and right, you know, literally, there were hundreds of people lined up all day to get autographs. So these new YouTube stars. But what was really interesting was that I heard, at least anecdotally, and, you know, I haven't had this confirmed, but that there are movies that are making more money now from clips that fans have uploaded onto YouTube. Google has auto-detected as copyrighted material and runs advertising against it and, you know, pays money to the studio. They're making more money from those fan clips than they're making from video rentals.
Wow.
You know, now, again, you know, anecdotal, but you look at stuff like that and you go, wow, you know, there's this sharing economy of people just doing stuff for each other, and it's starting to be monetized. And this notion that sharing economies are often monetized in unexpected ways is really interesting to me.
But, you know, if you say you should create more value than you try to extract, are you saying you should not concern yourself with extracting value?
What? Well, no, not at all. No, I've also said, you know, money is like gas in the car. You know, right, you're going on a road trip. You don't think it's a tour of gas stations, right. But you sure as heck don't want to run out of gas in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And I think businesses need to pay attention to making money, and I've been pretty successful at that. I mean, I have a very successful business that's been around for, you know, what, I think how old we are now, you know, 30.
Maybe you don't want to think about that, Tim.
And, with over $100 million in revenue. So I believe in making money.
Right.
You know,
but do you think that the principle of focusing on creating versus extracting helps you make money better?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean,
so it's fundamentally an altruistic.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it helps you in the long run. You know, like if you think about, there's a sweet spot in the middle. if you look at Google, as an example, in their early years, they were very clearly on the side of, we are creating value for a lot of other people. You know, they're sending traffic, creating this advertising. They've even done economic impact studies. Hal Varian, their chief economist, you know, done the economic impact of Google state by state, extrapolating from what people are spending on advertising to what benefit they must be getting from that and so on. But increasingly, you see Google saying, well, you know what? We used to send traffic to this site, but, you know, I think we can actually get more out of it if we own that site. And in some cases, they're making a really good judgment call where they're saying, actually, this is a better user experience. We can deliver more value that way to the customer. But I'm sure there's also this calculus of, well, actually, you know, we'll make money now. And I'm sorry, but, you know, site that used to be our friend, we're going to have to kill you. And that's exactly the pattern that I saw with Microsoft. You know, if you think through the 80s, you know, Microsoft was actually creating an enormous amount of value. That notion of a PC on every desk and in every home was incredibly democratizing, incredibly empowering. And they created this huge ecosystem. There were thousands of companies that were making money in their ecosystem. And bit by bit, you know, Microsoft said, no, actually, I think, you know, we got to own that.
Isn't that interesting? Because we were just talking about this. This is exactly what Twitter just did.
That's exactly right. And it's hard to say at any particular point that it's the wrong call. But it's very clear that over time, if you don't leave enough on the table, you vitiate your whole ecosystem. And then developers go somewhere else.
Right.
Because there's just not enough left there. And I remember once having a conversation with Walt Mossberg, who recounted to me a conversation that he had had with Steve Ballmer. And he said, Steve, you know, if you guys would just dial back the greed only 5%, it would make, you know, everybody would stop hating you. And it's that last little bit where people go too far. And I think, the notion that you have to create value and that you capture only so much of it and is, I think, really fundamental to business. You know, and you have great, you know, historical stories of this. You know, Henry Ford, you know, where he, you know, was no altruist, but he basically said, wow, if the people who work in my factory cannot afford my product, something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been pointing people, there's a really fabulous talk that was given at TED University in February by a guy named Nick Hanauer. Now, Nick's a very successful capitalist. He was the first non-family investor in Amazon.com. He subsequently went on to start Aquantiv, which was acquired by Microsoft for $6 billion.
So he's, that's the one they wrote off the investment in. But,
leave that aside. A little bit like Yahoo and Broadcast.com and Mark Cuban. They're people who have great luck with timing.
Yeah.
His talk, you know, he says, look, I'm a very successful capitalist, and I'm sick and tired of hearing about how capitalists create jobs. He says, there's only one thing that creates jobs, and that's customers. You know, if there are no customers to pay for the product, you know, all the capital in the world won't do you any good. And so you have to actually make sure that there's enough, you know, left so that the customers get some value too. And, you know, so he was talking about this whole problem of income inequality in the U.S. and saying, look, we've gutted the customer base and eventually our whole economic system is going to fall down. And, you know, so that's really, again, another illustration of this idea of you've got to think like an ecosystem, and you've got to build value. And, you know, again, this line, of Brian Irwin's, create more value when you than you capture, came out of it was an O'Reilly management retreat about 2000. And I was saying, you know, this telling story of more than one internet billionaire who said, oh, yeah, it started, you know, with an O'Reilly book. And I would go, yeah, right, great. We got, you know, our $34.95 and you got a billion. You know, that's pretty cool. You know, that we could create that much value. And yet, you know, we've had a successful business, and why should, you know, I just see so many companies that are like, a great example would be the for-profit colleges, you know, really unethical businesses for the most part, you know, where they're basically selling people, they're, you know, ripping off the government because it's funding, you know, they're getting people to apply for student loans. They're then promising them that if they take these courses, they'll get jobs, and then they're not delivering. You know, that's actually taking more out of the system than you put in. Whereas if somebody said, no, our job is really to help people get jobs, and if we don't, we're failing. You know, that would be a moral version of that, you know, mm-hmm. kind of institution.
It's that's interesting because, of course, this has changed because of the empowered consumer, has it not? I mean, companies have been doing this forever, but now they get caught because people know better.
Sometimes.
I mean, is that what's changed?
I don't think it's changed as much as we like to think it has.
Doc Searles would like it to have.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, it was a great tweet I saw the other day, you know, I was really dismayed to discover that customer relation management means sales. But this shit ought to be so much more to it than that.
No. but I do think that the empowered consumer is somewhat as keeping companies a little more honest about this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, really we have to have a revolution in business ethics, I think.
Well, that's my real question, is you're asking people to do something that historically they're not very good at, which is you're saying it's not altruism. Okay, I understand that. And maybe if you could convince them, it would be in their best interest to contribute more, to create more than they extract, then you could succeed. But it doesn't sound altruistic. It sounds
I think, you know, a lot of you know, there are a lot of great examples of the kinds of technologies that we're all proud of, and companies that we look at with admiration. They usually are value creators.
Right.
We know when somebody has crossed that line and starts to sort of suck the life out of a system. And, you know, I just hope that we can kind of get that meme out there so that companies are thinking more about that and saying, well, are we going over the line here?
You talked a little bit about the sharing economy. I just saw an interview you did with John Furrier about the sharing mm-hmm. economy. How does that fit into this?
Well, I've been thinking a bunch about the sharing economy, partly because, again, of this notion that, you know, income inequality, that if we don't have new ways for people to make money, at the bottom of the pyramid, the whole system will fail. And so I started saying, you know, there's that wonderful line, if something can't go on, it won't, you know?
Right.
And so the notion that a smaller and smaller number of people will extract more and more of the value as we've had in our culture, you know, is not a sustainable situation. Therefore, it cannot go on, and therefore it won't. And there's two ways that it will stop. One is there will be a bloody revolution like the French Revolution, which was, you know, of that same ilk of people, you know, kind of saying, well, let them eat cake.
So there's a good example of value extraction, the French royalty in the 18th century.
You know, a far better solution is for the market to start to adapt and say, well, let's find out how we can create a new economy. And just there's all these really interesting, you know, new business models that are around peer-to-peer. And again, I don't think they'll stay peer-to-peer. I mean, the web was originally peer-to-peer, but it kind of grew some big guys who kind of figured out how to monetize much better than the rest. But there's so many experiments across so many areas where, you know, there are people who are figuring out how to make a living in new ways. And some of that, you know, is explicitly sharing, but it's also how that sharing economy flips over into a monetary economy. You know, so you had couch surfing and now you have Airbnb. You had, various kinds of utopian sort of sharing, you know, communal this and communal that. Now you've got, Uber and relay rides and the like. You have, the rise of Kickstarter and the patronage economy. You have, this is not really sharing economy, but, you look at what happened with eBay. You know, eBay was this incredibly democratizing force for small sellers who were able to, to do peer-to-peer transactions. eBay discovered there was a lot more money in the big guys. They leaned much more heavily that way. Well, they created a new opportunity for Etsy, and Etsy comes in and sort of focuses again on the little guys, the more peer-to-peer. I mentioned YouTube already. The new face of the entertainment economy. People who are, putting stuff up, often, with no hope of getting paid, but some of them figure out, wow, I could get paid here. In the same way that some people, started out, blogging, and then some of them figured out they get paid to do it. And so I'm just interested in all the new ways that people are finding to do interesting work that other people care enough about that they're willing to pay for it.
It's an interesting consequence of this internet revolution that you saw happening in the early 90s, just way ahead of everybody else. Did you foresee these kinds of creative upwellings?
I don't think I've ever spent much time trying to foresee the future.
Yeah, it's pretty hard.
I think, I like what Hal Varian of Google talks about. He talks about nowcasting. He's saying, you just get better at what's happening now.
Yeah.
Most of the things that I have called, yes, they've unfolded in the future. When we were saying... I still remember the moment when I said to Dale Dougherty when we were working on GNN, I think people will have the web browser open on their desk all the time.
No.
We were originally talking about GNN as sort of a quarterly magazine, online magazine.
It went from that to a portal.
Yeah, and it was like, no, people will have this up on their desk all the time, And, there was a time when we were first showing that thing where people couldn't tell what was the software, what was the content. You couldn't even read a web page, It's like, you mean you can click on this text and it does something? All these things that we take for granted now. And I think in a similar, so all we did was just try to call attention to the future that was already happening, which is why I use that great William Gibson quote all the time. The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed
right,
yet.
Right.
So when I started talking about data and the importance of data back, 10 years ago, it was just like, hey, that's really the secret sauce of all these, these companies, and it was sort of also thinking a lot about what happened with the PC. IBM had this incredible hardware monopoly. The PC commoditized the hardware business. Oh, wait, why did Microsoft end up with this software monopoly? And I thought, well, gosh, hardware is commoditized, software becomes valuable. Now software is being commoditized by the internet and open source. What's going to become valuable?
Hardware.
No, data.
I think Microsoft thinks hardware, but maybe they're looking at Apple going, they're making a lot of money over there. But you're right, big data.
That was the whole, to me, that was the heart of what I was talking about with Web 2.0 was this idea that it was data that was valuable. Now, I think you're actually right that, then people would say, what's after data? And I'd say, I have no idea. I'm not seeing it yet. And of course, I think you're right. It actually may have turned out to be hardware again. If you look at Apple, sort of figuring out how do you get a design premium on, user experience in hardware. And of course, the whole maker movement is taking us back in that direction of figuring out how to make, unique and interesting hardware.
That was another brilliant stroke, Make Magazine. And the maker movement is really, we interviewed Lady Ada Vadafruit just a couple of weeks ago, and you're really seeing an amazing and growth in this maker movement that I think you predicted. That you were the first I heard to talk about it, and Dale and the maker folks.
came up with that. We
were paying attention to hardware. We were doing some books on it. And remember, we were a taxi cab up at the open source convention up in Portland, and Dale Sturzman, he said, you know, I'd like to do a magazine about all the people who are behind this new hardware movement. And I said, sure, go work on it. And, yeah, he came up with Make and then launched Maker Faire. And, yeah, we had 120,000 people at Maker Faire this year. So it's really – we did definitely call something there.
Amazing, yeah.
Dale is really the one who saw that. And I think it's true. He was also the one who kind of brought us to the World Wide Web in 1992. So
should find out what Dale's doing next.
That's right. Well, he's working on an education project, making an education.
That is a very hot subject. In fact, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to ask you what you think about Khan Academy and Udacity and the future of education. You've talked. We had last time you were on. We talked about the future of government. Let's talk about the future of education. That's a fascinating era. Our guest Tim O'Reilly, creator of O'Reilly Media, publisher of so many great books, so many great conferences about Web 2.0, big data, and on and on. And of course, I think one of the great thinkers out there right now. We'll have more with Tim in just a minute. But first, I'd like to think about the post office. Boy, there's a platform that could be remade. Wouldn't it be cool? How about this? If you didn't have to have a post office, you obviously have to have some way of delivering goods. But what if you could, you know, do it all from your desk? Like you could print the postage from your computer and your printer, and like, and somebody would come and take the package, and they would just say, okay, good, I see the, and they would deliver it. Wouldn't that be, that's stamps.com. Talk about a fascinating business. Stamps.com, with help from the U.S. Postal Service, allows you to really bring the Postal Service to your desktop. You print your own postage. They've got a USB scale. In fact, I'll show you how to get that scale free in a second. That you plug into your computer. You plop the letter on there. You could print right on the envelope, so you don't even need stamps. If you want sticky stamps, you can print on them, too. They've got it all, and packages too. And it integrates so nicely if you're an eBay seller or Amazon seller right with the eBay and Amazon pages, so you don't have to type out the buyer's name and address. It's all in there. If you're doing international mailing, it's fantastic. It fills out all the forms for you. And you never have to get up from your desk unless you want to do something else, because the mail carrier comes on their daily rounds, or you can schedule a free pickup and comes and takes it, and that's it. It's done. I want you to try Stamps.com. If you do any amount of mailing at all, this is really not only economical, they do have discounts, you can't get to the post office, but just a major time saver. Visit Stamps.com, but don't do that $80 value, because I got a better offer for you. If you heard about it on the radio or podcast, right, that microphone, click that, and then use our offer code Triangulation. That's the promo code, Triangulation. And that $80 value turns into $100, $110 value, $55 in coupons. The digital scale, you pay the postage and handling, shipping and handling. I think it's $5. Make that up. They give you a $5 supply kit and a four-week trial for free. All of that when you use our offer code Triangulation. That's a secret backdoor to the good stuff at stamps.com. Don't go to the post office. Just use stamps.com. Tim O'Reilly is our guest. We started.
Can I throw in something about the post office?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that a business like the post office needs to do is to decompose themselves into a set of assets and a set of values that they could deliver. You know, this goes back to the, capturing value, delivering value. You know, you start thinking about your business as, oh my God, how do we survive? How do we make money? How do we keep doing what we do? You're caught in a rut. But if you ask yourself, what assets do we have? What problems can we solve? What value can we deliver? You know, you might get yourself into a completely different business. So a really good one for the post office, for example, is a set of people who visit every home.
Right.
In America once a day. What if they became part of the healthcare system? You know, what if they said, you know, we're the ones who are going to check up on, you know, Aunt Jane and see if she's taking her meds, you know, or whatever, just even she's, you know, okay. You know, I mean, there's a whole set of, you know, you look at our aging demographics, there's a whole set of people who are isolated. You go, the post office could be a real force for something completely different than delivering mail. You know, because just by saying, okay, yeah, we check up on things. You know, they could become home security. You know, we check in on your house, you know, and make sure that everything's okay. You know, they could, you know, and I'm not saying that any of these are what they should do, but, you know, that's just one of their assets is the fact that they've got this massive workforce that visits every home. What else could you provide to customers as part of that? I'm walking by. You could imagine how, they could, be the equivalent of a task rabbit that says, even I think about things, you know, you go away and, you want to, not have your newspapers piling up in front of your house telling people that you're gone. Okay. But the mailman can go take the stuff and put it around the back. You know, and for only $7 a month, they'll take care of these kinds of things for you or whatever. You know, who knows what it is, you know.
But that's a really good example of how we do get in a rut. We say, no, but this is what we do. And and that's all we're going to ever do, and because that's what we do. And it's hard in a business. And I think there are very few businesses. Look at, you know, Kodak, which tried to reinvent itself and hasn't done so with success. It's tough.
Yeah, well, and sometimes it's, you know, it really goes back to, well, what do we actually do? And it's very interesting. I remember reading The Life of Ben Franklin.
Who invented the post office.
He did, at least here in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's really interesting for him. You know, it was this really interesting virtuous circle between the post office, the print shop, and the newspaper.
Right.
Leverage. He became, you know, he was kind of the Rupert Murdoch or Bill Gates of his day. He became enormously successful, you know, sold his papers and then retired to a life of science. But, you know, he realized that if he owned the post office, he'd get the news first. He'd print, he'd have the most successful newspaper. And of course, that was business for his print shop, you know, and he was pretty ruthless at, you know, getting control of all the mail routes, you know, then forcing people out of business or to sell to him.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah. By saying, you know, it's like, hey, I got the news. You know, do you want, you know, it's like,
wow.
Or, you know, sell me your paper. And he kind of built this multi-state empire of local newspapers that were fueled by the post office. So he's kind of a robber baron in ways that you don't quite.
It's not the legend I learned in sixth grade. I could tell you that right now. What about the kite, the key, the whole thing? You know, it's interesting. It really comes down to having a free mind, an ability to create outside of the boundaries that most normal people, most of us are, we ride on rails. Why is it some people are able to get out there and think creatively like that? Can you learn that?
Well, yeah, I think you can. I think you can. And a big part of it, you know, there's a kind of epistemology that can be learned. You know, we don't really do a lot of introspection to realize how we think. And I actually, it was part of, you know, growing up in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s. I worked with a guy named George Simon, who was, taught workshops at Esalen and the like. And he had this wonderful notion of this. He was influenced by general semantics, which you can go, you know, Google for it and you'll find some interesting ideas. But he was really had this notion of kind of like a firing order of perception that there's something real out there. We perceive it. We then, you know, process it in some way. And, you know, the general semantics notion is the map is not the territory. A lot of people live in the map, you know, that they heard something or they believe something and, you know, they don't go back to, well, let's go back and look at reality fresh. And what George did was he actually taught that as kind of a process to notice whether you were stuck in the map or whether you were really paying attention to the thing itself. And, general semantics of the map not being the territory, and he actually built a practice around, okay, how do you become mindful of where you are in that process? And it really influenced me because I think it did free me from, you know, just being stuck in the kind of received knowledge that you get from other people. And I think, you know, obviously there were a lot of life choices I made that contributed to that. You know, the fact that I lived up in Sebastopol, I wasn't in the hurly-burly of Silicon Valley, gave me distance. And so I would kind of be looking and thinking, well, what does that mean? You know, as opposed to kind of just buying into what everybody else was believing.
If you're kind of a hippie. Are you a hippie?
Not really.
I like hippies. I'm not saying any negative thing here. But I have to think, you know, I've always thought that, I mean, I look at people like Steve Jobs. The technology revolution was fueled by the thinking of the 60s.
Totally. No question. I mean, obviously, that's the point of John Markoff's book, What the Dormouse Said. And I do think there are some real connections. This art of thinking fresh thoughts is not well taught.
No. And it's interesting because it's clearly informed you. You are one of the most creative thinkers I've ever heard. And it's clear that that's what you're doing.
Well, a lot of it's pattern recognition, you know, too. I think back when I first got into the computer industry, you know, I was trained in Greek and Latin classics. And there was a lot in common between reading a computer manual about a system that I knew nothing about and reading a Latin or Greek text. Mm. You know, like not being a native speaker, you know, nobody really is anymore. You know, you get there and you read the words and you kind of understand most of the words, but you don't quite see how they fit together, you know, because it's just not natural to you. And some of the words you don't even know, you have to look them up. And bit by bit, though, the pattern emerges and you go, oh, that word goes with that. Here's what it means. And it goes, it's like doing a puzzle, you know. And so when I was doing computer manuals, I remember one manual in particular I was writing. It was for a company called MassComp. Basically, there were these three different engineers who had written specs for different subsystems. And I realized, oh, they were really talking about different pieces of the same system. And, you know, we'd originally kind of rewritten each of the chapters, made them readable. You know, the spec to this became, you know, the blah, blah subsystem, and this was the blah, blah subsystem, and that was the organization of the manual. And at one point, I just went, holy shit, I see how they're all connected now. You know, and I went, we got to rewrite this manual from the ground up.
The blind man and the elephant. You saw the elephant.
I suddenly saw the elephant and I went, oh, wait, no, we have to, you know, now I can tell it from the user point of view as opposed to, you know, the creator point of view. They talked about their own little piece and that was like, oh, now I see how all these things connect. But it was sort of like that, very similar to that experience I'd have, you know, parsing a Greek text, right. You know, suddenly you go, oh, wait, that goes with that, you know.
Oh, I get it.
And I guess I've always done that. I kind of go, oh, there's a pattern here. You know, what is it?
Well, let's get to education then. That's certainly something we could do well to teach. What do you think of education these days?
There's clearly a lot of ferment and a lot of disruption happening in education.
Mm-hmm.
You look at some of these online course platforms. You look at Khan Academy. They're kind of shaking the people up. Our particular angle on it is, with Make. If you saw, we've been running a Make summer camp.
I love that on Google Plus. Yeah.
Dale is really passionate about education. We actually have a DARPA grant to put makerspaces into 1,000 schools over the next 3 years. 1,000 high schools. And of course, there's been some controversy over that with people saying, oh my God, you're taking money from the military. What are you doing trying to be recruiting for them? No, they just go, you know, the military says, oh my God, you know, if we don't have a science literate population, we're screwed. You know? And there's a lot of long-term thinkers in the military. And DARPA basically says, you know, we've got to get people who are conversant with, you know, 21st century skills. And that's, you know, making is a big part of that. We've lost a piece of our national character. You know, people used to be able to make things and now we don't make them anymore. We got to get that back. So there's really no hidden agenda there. They really are just saying this is a cool project and they're really looking to see this sort of maker, you know, as part of the whole STEM education, fascination. How do we get people interested in science and math again? And they really get, oh, the best way is by doing, you know, and, you know, what Dale's, really focused on is this notion that if you get people to do things that they really are excited about, then they have to learn the skills in order to do, you know, and it's such a reversal of how we normally teach. You know, we're going to make people, you know, learn all this stuff without actually ever letting them apply it. And then finally, you know, after they've had several years of theory, they finally get to be hands-on. That's kind of nuts, You know, it should be the other way. You get hands-on, and then you learn the theory in order to get better at hands-on. That's, of course, how we learn programming. You know, we sit there and we go, we're trying to do something, and we copied somebody's, you know, other program or, you know, their web page or their whatever. And then you go, well, that's kind of interesting. How did they do that? And then you start reading about the thing that you need to know, and you learn because you're trying to do something. And that's really Dale's fundamental insight about the connection between making and education. There's also that really is the connection of these new 21st century tools, you know, 3D printing, you know, the ability to do 3D visualizations and designs and then make them is really, really interesting. Electronics is coming back around on the guitar as a skill that really matters. But that fundamental notion is, you know, thinking about rethinking education around what can you do rather than what do you know? Because if you can do something, then you obviously know enough to do it. And if you can't do it, then you need to figure out what you need to learn.
It does feel like just as the incumbents in media and the incumbents in every business are falling, the incumbents in education are ripe.
They're very ripe, and the business model. You know, when you sit there with Sebastian Thrun of Udacity, he had the AI Stanford AI class with Peter Norvig, and he's kind of doing the math for you. And he said, you know, if we really have even, you know, because they had what 100,000 students sign up or some very large number, and
yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, and he said, well, suppose that not all our courses are that good, but let's just say that we could have, you know, 5,000 students per class. You know, he said, well, I could deliver a computer science degree for $500. Not only that, he kind of said, and not only that, you know, only 4% of Stanford students got a perfect score on all my quizzes. You know, 8% of students worldwide did. So that means there's a lot of people who did way better than the people in my Stanford class.
Wow.
There were thousands of them, you know, all over the world. And you start, you know, I said, so, you know, why don't you just sort of think about if you again, going back to that same notion I said about the post office, if you decompose a college degree into the various functions, you go, okay, well, there's a, you know, a social experience part of it. There's, you know, getting to, you know, this learning and there's accreditation, you know, and you kind of think from the accreditation point of view, if you can say, wow, I actually got measured and did better against my peers around the world through this competitive process, and that's a better accreditation than I went to Stanford and maybe I sucked there.
Mm-hmm.
You have a really disruptive possibility, but it's sort of decomposing, you know, the thing into what job does it do again. Again, I use that notion of what job do you do a lot in publishing too. You know, I've given a lot of talks on that topic, you know, because if people think a book is one kind of thing, they're wrong. You know, I gave a talk at one point at one publishing conference where I showed the Google autonomous vehicle with the caption, "This used to be a book."
Okay, explain that.
Well, you think about it. You know, Rand McNally wrote Atlas.
Yeah.
You know, you had this book, had all these maps and directions, and then the intermediate stage was, wow, we made this nice interactive WYSIWYG. You know, touch screen even, you know, you kind of look at the evolution of online mapping over the last decade. And then you say, well, where's it ending up? It's ending up, you know, where you might say to your car, take me to Safeway, you know, and or take me to Joe's house, take me to Leo's new office. And I don't actually have to have any visualization at all. I certainly don't need the book. You know, the information product has become subsumed into the service.
Right.
And
that's somewhat true already with the GPS or even the smartphone.
That's right. That's right. And you look at different ways that, you know, things that used to be information products really become services.
Services, yeah.
And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And it's just like, okay, well, you know, whereas, say, a book, a novel is competing with other forms of entertainment, you know, certain kinds of you know, functional books are really competing with new ways and better ways of doing that function.
Do you see yourself 10 years from now still doing what you're doing? Do you have – would you like to retire? Well, and if you did, what would you do?
Well, I kind of feel like I'm already doing what I would do. You know, I've got a pretty good team at O'Reilly that's – doing the business, most of the business, and I go out, spend a lot of time out there learning about interesting things, talking to interesting people, you know, whether it's for our venture firm or possible authors or possible conference promoters who are just trying to inform myself about the future in a way that I can shape, you know, company direction. So I'm, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, sharing what I'm thinking, you know, via social media. So I just, you know, I don't see why I would stop doing that. I'm working a lot with, still on the open government front with, you know, Code for America and other organizations. I trying to shape government policy. I'm spending more time, I suppose, on thinking about, you know, larger problems, rather than just, you know, how do I make my company work? Cause I think that's working pretty well on its own. You know, so I'm sitting there saying, you know, how do we deal with the problem of income inequality? How can I, you know, what can I learn from people out on the cutting edge that might help us make healthcare better? And then that leads to a new business area. You know, we just launched our Strata RX conference, which is about big data in healthcare, because I'm convinced that a lot of what's happening on the consumer internet with data can help actually bend the cost curve on healthcare. And that's one of our big social problems. If we don't get medical costs under control, our economy is going to be really screwed and our government's going to be really screwed. You know, if you look at you know, what Code for America is doing, Jan Palka has this great line, you know, she says, you know, what would it be like if people felt the way about government they feel about their iPhone? You know, could we make interfaces to government simple, beautiful, and easy to use? You know, and you think about the social impact of that, the change in the way our society works. If we can actually apply technology to some of these big problems. So that I'm spending a lot of time thinking about those kinds of issues and then using my bully pulpit to get other people, you know, working on them. So for example, Todd Park, who was the CTO at Health and Human Services, now the CTO of the United States, is launching tomorrow morning this Presidential Innovation Fellows program. You know, I introduced these guys to Eric Ries of the Lean Startup, and Todd totally got it. And he's trying to do Lean Startup with government agencies. He's got little Lean Startup teams modeled on what we've done at Code for America with cities. And he's going into federal agencies and saying, okay, you have, you know, small groups of technologists who are going to try to make really cool products, a minimum viable product in the Eric Ries style, in you know, in 6 weeks or 10 weeks, you know, and they're going to deliver, you know, and you think about, you know, maybe it's not just the apps, it's the culture change that goes with that, you know, it's changing, you know, government from this, you know, we're going to spend 2 years in procurement and another 5 years getting it built, to, oh my God, we could have a real product that makes a difference quickly. And you, again, I feel like things like that, I'm spending a lot of time on how do we actually bring these ideas from our world into other worlds that need it, like healthcare or government.
I was going to ask you as my last question, do you feel a little quixotic? Do you feel like, you know, you're kind of an optimist in a world of cynics? But, you know, you're actually really achieving quite a bit here. You're making some real progress here.
I am. I have to say, I'm actually pretty pleased with the impact that, you know, like when I went and launched the Gov2 events, you know, and I kind of went around, talked to a bunch of people, and I kind of came up with this notion of government as a platform. And how could we change the notion of government from this end-to-end service delivery model, you know, which is not working, to one where we say, could government do less and yet actually deliver more services to citizens because we've put in place, you know, the right kinds of government spending, you know, and that's really having a big influence. And I love when I can have an idea like that and then illustrate and say, look, okay, we did it with GPS, you know, it's like, so I had this bumper sticker, you know, Ronald Reagan is the father of Foursquare. You know?
It's true.
Reagan is the one who basically said, let's open GPS to civilians. You know, and you know, our whole geospatial industry came out of government investment and government policy. Well, okay, well, where else could they act like that now? And I think a lot of what's happening in healthcare is like that. Okay, if we get electronic medical records, if we can start to get more support for evidence-based medicine, if we could, you know, there's all these things where we're going to try to get, the government is trying to get the private sector enabled with the right kind of tools to make a better system. But it's not government delivering the system. It's government delivering the framework on which the private sector will build that system. And I think that's a really powerful notion, and one I'm really pleased to have kind of put together. And again, I'm kind of out there thinking about, you know, what do I see that tells us stories that need to be told more widely and that might help people to do more interesting work and make better things happen.
Tim, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
All right, you're very welcome. It's always a pleasure talking with you, Leo.
Tim.O'Reilly.com if you want to see kind of a compilation of so many articles and pieces Tim's done. And, of course, O'Reilly is a great place to go. O'Reilly.com, radar.O'Reilly.com. There's so many. That site by itself, it's like the old GNN. It's full of great stuff. And lots of learning. And, of course, I know books are dead, but keep publishing them because I got a lot of
they're
value.
They're not dead yet, and I have to say our ebook business is booming. And
well, you know, the last three O'Reilly books I bought, I wanted to learn JavaScript, so, of course, I bought three O'Reilly books. I bought the ebook plus the textbook, the paper book.
That's what we like to hear that.
It was perfect.
Good.
Yeah. Because now I have it, see, you know, especially when you're learning a programming language, having something that lies flat like that you can look at. But having it on the iPad and on the Kindle, too, is very, very, very valuable. And you put it in all those formats. Thank you, Tim.
You're very welcome. All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. Tim O'Reilly, at Tim O'Reilly, really worth following on Twitter. Very good stuff. Lots of provocative links and thoughts. If you want to just continue this kind of conversation that we've been having for the last hour. We do triangulation every Wednesday at it's about 3 o'clock, thereabouts, Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. It's 2200 UTC if you want to join us live. Love it. Love watching the chat room. I know you're the third leg of the stool, and I didn't ask you that. I was so engrossed with Mr. O'Reilly, I didn't get a chance to give you your questions, but I was watching, and I asked as many as I could. We do really like it if you watch live because it really helps me out. You do all my research and stuff. Yeah, but if you can't, we make on-demand versions available after the fact at twit.tv/TRI, or just subscribe, and then you won't miss an episode. We've had so many great episodes as of late, some really fascinating people. In fact, be worthwhile if you haven't heard all 66 episodes going back to the beginning and just picking and choosing the ones you're interested in. Some great ideas in there. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you next Wednesday on Triangulation. Bye-bye.